2 weeks from this morning, while you're sitting here, I will be backpacking up out of the Grand Canyon. You might want to have a special prayer, but I am not sure I would wish to guess to what end. One of the cardinal rules of public speaking is that you don't get your audience mad at you in the opening sentence. I may be about to violate that rule, depending on how tolerant you feel, when I suggest that on a scale of 1 to 10, when it comes to reading the Bible, Congregationalists probably rank right up there with Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and Unitarians. That is somewhere between 3 and 4. But that may not be quite as bad as it sounds. I have found no clear proof that scoring a 9 or a 10 is always a sign of a superior Christian life. It may matter more how you read the Bible than how much. But a low score does make me feel once in a while that I should preach some expository sermons in which the actual text of Scripture is looked at closely, and that's what we're doing this morning. Last week, we read the opening line of the Apostle Paul's letter to a small Greek church he had just established. From Paul, Silas, and Timothy, to the congregation of the Thessalonians, grace to you and peace. That was as far as we got, but I promised the pace would pick up. After the traditional greeting, Paul's letters usually had a paragraph of thanksgiving, and this one is no exception. We always thank God for all of you and mention you in our prayers continually. We call to mind before our God how your faith has shown itself in action, your love in labor, and your hope in fortitude. Things often came in threes in the religion of that day, and Paul especially liked the trinity of faith, hope, and love. And since all three of them are still vital parts of Christian experience, let's take a quick look at how he qualifies each one. When he speaks of how their faith has shown itself in work, Paul chooses a Greek noun that means extremely demanding toil. He wants to make the point strongly that if faith doesn't sweat at times, it's rather useless. The same point made in the book of James. What good does it do if you say you have faith and you do nothing? If somebody is hungry, for example, it is not enough to say, go in peace, may you be filled, and give nothing. Faith, in other words, is a cup of soup, not a mouthful of sentiment. It sounds so good to say, I believe, that we often settle for the words and sit back pleased. I believe that this project will succeed. Some might have said of our hopes to build this church 4 years ago, but 1,000 could have said it, and nothing at all happened until someone like Glenn James, present in spirit and in memory, stood up and said to our meeting, I am retired, and I do not have the reserves Juanita and I would like, but we will give the first $5,000. I will always believe that his opening remark set a mood that made this building possible. There are in all enterprises those who talk and those who do. So Paul is grateful, first of all, for those in the Thessalonian church whose faith fed the hungry, consoled the frightened, visited the sick. In the second unit of his Trinity, he praises them for what he calls their labor of love. Labor may seem an odd word to use in connection with love, but love has its proof, too. I love you, one says to another, but there is never the impulsive note left on the table, never the quick hug, the unexpected moment of praise, the squeeze of the hand, the dish towel shared in the kitchen, the cold drink brought out to the one working on the car or mowing the lawn. I love you is a sweet melody on the tongue, but it is truly believable when it sings itself in the music of an act. And last in the trilogy of what Paul says to this beloved group is what he calls your steadfast hope. His sequence seems logical. If faith has to work and love has to labor, then the temptation will be to wear out and give up. Paul says, don't do that. Don't get tired and quit. Let your hope keep you strong and steady. The Phillips translation calls it sheer dogged endurance. Not a very exciting virtue, not one we give medals for or headlines in the newspaper, but if you've ever taught a student, managed a business, built a church, you know that all these adventures are shipwrecked without steadfast hope that sticks it out to the end. Well, it's quite a challenge. Faith that does something, love that works, hope that won't give up. High praise for the members of this new little church, and Paul is not quite finished. We are certain, brothers, beloved by God, that He has chosen you. And there are two things that catch my eye when I read that. First, that he calls them brothers. Not brothers and sisters. Paul hasn't learned about inclusive language yet. But there is more drama in the word brothers than we realize at first. Here is a proud Pharisee of the Jewish nation, embracing as part of his own intimate family a bunch of Gentiles he once despised. In Paul's new faith, barriers as forbidding as the Berlin Wall had crumbled. The idea is so novel for him and so exhilarating that he uses the word brother 21 times. In his two brief letters to this church, and he uses the word brethren in the plural 7 times. I'm not sure he thought there was any hope yet for a universal brotherhood, but he had found a working model in the diversity of the young Christian churches, and he couldn't stop talking about it. We are part of the family of God, he kept telling them. No longer Jew or Gentile, Greek or barbarian, but children of the same Maker. If you'd like to recapture the magic Paul felt, try to imagine this. In Beirut, a city that hate has destroyed, Christian and Muslim suddenly discover some overriding loyalty that makes them lay down their arms, meet each other not only in peace, but in mutual respect, and set out together to rebuild a once beautiful place. It seems completely impossible. But minor miracles of that kind happened in those first century churches, and Paul never quite got over the excitement of a new revelation. We were meant to be brothers. Minor question. Were we also meant to turn that family word into a title and address one another in church as Brother Caraway or Sister Schweizer? If so, we are remiss in this church because we don't do it. And I'm glad we don't, even though I grew up in a church that did. We brothered and sistered everybody in church on Sunday morning and on the street during the week. But some of us who by and by joined other churches and dropped the habit years ago would now find that old greeting rather strange and awkward. Why? Well, the answer is partly cultural and partly a matter of theology. Let me ask you a question. What flavor does the expression Brother Brown have when you read it in a novel or hear it in a theater? Isn't it true that those media use it almost without exception to poke a little fun at certain kinds of churches? No one expects to be brothered or sistered in a Presbyterian church or an Episcopal church or in Unitarian or Congregational churches, so that this form of greeting has come to be a signal, a clue to what kind of church one has entered. I think that any good student of religious life in America could be taken blindfolded into a church and within minutes pick up all sorts of signals as to the kind of church it is. Once in a while, when Billy and I are around the people of our own childhood church, somebody will introduce us as Brother and Sister Myers. They are warm, friendly people who have no idea how strange that has come to sound to us. I revert to that custom sometimes in a church like this with a kind of affectionate humor. I address the choir director as Brother Scott, and he returns the favor. But we are dressing up for a moment in antique clothing, and we both know it. But, and this is the only important part of all of this, if we don't use the titles, we do need to remind ourselves often that we are meant to be like a family and that we are not a church if we fail. If the early Christians did not brother and sister one another, they certainly had strong feelings about their new relationship. Children of one God, brothers and sisters in one family. The idea never meant that we would turn into heaps of melted sugar or that we would always like each other. Brothers and sisters may like each other, but as you know perfectly well, they may not. The essential thing is that they love each other, which runs deeper than liking. The relationship between them or among them is authenticated not by their wishing to take vacation trips together, but by their being glad for each other's good luck, hurt by each other's misfortune, bound by the bonds of family to support each other in time of need. Now, the idea that people of different educational and economic levels, different colors and languages, might come together as a family is one of the great gifts of the early church. So like a child with a great new joy, Paul, the Jewish scholar, calls the Greek shopkeeper his brother. He also calls his friends something else, which should make us pause for a moment. We are certain, brothers, beloved by God, that He has chosen you. I hope that word makes you flinch a little. We've had grief and tragedy enough in this world from groups that see themselves as the chosen. The word rightly scares us. It smacks of arrogance and exclusivism. It conjures up images of the Aryan Nation or the Ku Klux Klan or the late Ayatollah and his true believers. And then, on top of that, we have problems with logic. If we really are predestined, and in some sense Paul thought we were, what happens to freedom of choice? How do we keep the non-chosen from feeling bitter and hopeless? And how do we keep the chosen from feeling smug and superior? This whole business of being elected or predestined in some way is an unsolved mystery in the New Testament. People are said to be chosen, yet they are held strictly accountable for their lives. Paul never makes it clear how he resolves that paradox. He simply accepts both ideas. He never once hinted that he or anyone else was chosen on the basis of merit or goodness, but that somehow in the mysteries of God's providence, they had been picked to do a job. And without going back to the tortured logic or the dreadful anxieties of Calvinism, we can still make the words relevant. We were called to be a church. We were chosen to be a special body in which the Spirit of Christ dwells. Keeping that in mind can keep us from turning into a country club, which we were not meant to be. Paul has one more compliment for his new church before he settles down to talk of other things. He says, "People everywhere have heard how you turned from idols to serve the true and living God." The careless reader thinks, "Why should I be interested in this? There are no idols anymore." The truth is, there are as many as ever. Not made of marble or brass in the image of some ancient god, but the intangible gods we worship in our minds. We have as many of those as any Greek or Roman. We make them out of abstract nouns, which is the most treacherous and explosive thing in the world to do. We ought to obey God rather than men, our scripture says. But in the name of a false patriotism, abstract noun, we idolize our different nations and foolishly find them perfect. We write "In God We Trust" on our currency, but we make a god of military might and trust it far more. If our real God is not the God we worship here on Sunday, but the gods we serve during the week, then some of us most truly worship our professions, our families, our business. We turn the good thing, success, into a goddess to whom we will sacrifice anything to win favor. Being number one, we think, is every person's manifest destiny. And growth must be a god, because we sing songs and preach sermons about how everything is meant to get bigger. Even in churches, we talk more about numbers as a mark of our success than we do about changed lives. If we are honest, we know the names of all the gods we elevate. So Paul's praise to his first century friends has the ring of relevance. It is always the mark of a genuine student of Christ that she has turned away from contemporary idols to serve the true and living God. The ancient letter we read is not so foreign after all. Next week, Paul describes the kind of preacher he is. It's a very instructive paragraph when you measure it against many of us. And he tells the people at Thessalonica how he would like them to live for the rest of their lives. There is a word for us. Please come back.